A new report says the global war on drugs has failed, and governments should consider legalizing marijuana and other controlled substances. The report came from the Global Commission on Drug Policy, a group that consists of former world leaders, including a former president of Mexico. Officials in Mexico dismiss this report. They say legalization would not stop the drug cartels who control the drug trade. Since 2006, when Mexican President Felipe Calderón declared war on the drug cartels, more than 34,000 people have died in drug-related violence, many of them killed by men like the one we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes. He was a sicario, a hitman for the drug cartels, who lived to tell his story. He worked for the cartels and the state police at the same time, and he even attended an FBI training camp in the United States. But he left that life behind after finding God, and now there's a price on his head. And a warning to listeners, this conversation does contain some graphic descriptions of the violence that he participated in. Journalist Chuck Bowden and his translator Molly Malloy edited the book El Sicario, the autobiography of a Mexican assassin. And they join us from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Chuck, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Molly, welcome to you.
Nice to be here.
And Chuck, let's start with you. Remind us of how you met the sicario and why he wanted you to tell his life story.
Well, a friend of mine was protecting him. He had a $250,000 contract on his head. I called in a favor. I've always wanted one of these people to come forward, one of these killers. That's why he talked to me initially. After that, he liked talking. He had a message he wanted to deliver, and he decided I could help him deliver it.
Why does he want to deliver this message? What purpose does he think he'll gain from this?
He thinks he's going to hell. He thinks he's evil. He thinks he's done terrible things. And he wants to not only renounce the life he used to live, but renounce the system that created him so it'll stop. He's like a missionary from hell.
Do you think he's evil?
I think he's done evil things. He's killed hundreds of people, tortured them. But look, I know him. And my reality is, I don't think he's very different than I am, except he's done terrible things and I haven't. What people want to know is he a sociopath or psychopath? I don't think so. I think he's an actual standard human being, only unusually intelligent and with an absolutely barbarous past.
Molly, what about you? When the interviews with the sicario were conducted for this book, you were there. What was it like for you?
You know, I felt like I should have been scared. But I honestly didn't feel it. And once we started talking, it was essentially business. And my job was to do the best translation as I could. And to do that, you have to intensely concentrate on what's being said. But he has an intense desire to tell this story and to try to prevent other young men from being sucked into the life that he lived. And he thinks that this is part of the payback. It's something that he can do to try to atone for the terrible sins of his life.
When he talks about his family and the joy he had when his father took him to the circus, although he grew up in poverty, he seemed to have a fairly happy childhood.
He did this for money. He has 12 siblings who threw him out of the family because he was doing this. He wanted the money. He wanted to have the girls. He wanted the car, which is one of the reasons I think he finds his own behavior difficult to forgive. He is not a victim, in other words.
Right. He says over and over again that he wanted the fast life. He even uses this analogy based on one of the stories he tells of having to play basketball with a ball that leaked air fairly quickly. So their basketball games in the barrio would only last 20 or 30 minutes. And he says, you know, this became something that really symbolized what my life was. I wanted everything fast. I didn't want to have to work for things. I wanted to be able to get the money really fast. And he realizes now, I think he probably even realized then, that this was a bad way to live. But it was his choice.
And he was recruited then as a teenager by the drug cartels. Can you tell us about that, Chuck?
He was recruited to run loads across the bridge into El Paso in a car for $50 a haul. And you got to understand, he came from real poverty. The first time he got $50, he had the biggest thrill of his life up till then. Afterwards, he's working for the drug cartel. They send him to the police academy, arrange it. State of Chihuahua pays him $150 a month. The cartel pays him $1,000 a month. By the time he's 18, he's a comandante, in Juarez in charge of the anti-kidnapping unit, also running a cell of criminals who do all the kidnapping. We're not talking about a rogue cop. We're talking about a system. This is the cop. This is the face of power in Mexico. He wasn't corrupted. He is the product of a system that is totally corrupt.
I don't think he ever thought that he was being trained for a legitimate job. He went into it fully knowing that he was being groomed to work for the drug cartels, and that what the drug cartels do is use the police academies, and not just the state police, but the federal police, the military, the army, to basically contract out the training for their operatives. It's a way to get the Mexican government to pay for the training that will then be used by these criminal organizations.
He could pass through any barrier, go to an airport, fly anywhere, had his own pilot. It wasn't like, well, there's this one little town or city that's a little crooked or something. He was part of a fabric that blanketed the entire nation.
Does he tell you, does he even know how many people he may have killed over the 20 years that he was involved in this?
He did tell me once. I said, how many secret death houses are there in Juarez? He said, look, the city's a cemetery. I know where 250 bodies are buried. And, of course, what he was telling me was there were 250 people he'd put in holes in the ground. What he did isn't just kill people. I mean, good God, Molly and I have been dealing with somebody who's boiled people alive. He didn't invent these things. He's an 18-year-old taught these things. This is a culture of horror to control people.
You know, in the book, there are many drawings done by the Sicario that he apparently did while you were talking with him, and a lot of diagrams about the way the cartels were organized, the way the government works, the death houses. And we have a film clip from the documentary that was made along with the book. And in this clip, the Sicario is describing how he tortured people. Let's listen to that.
Se le rocía gasolina o alcohol a la manta.
And I'm wondering, Molly, if you can translate what he's saying.
We cover the body with a sheet, sprinkle gasoline or alcohol onto the sheet, and when it is soaked, light it with a match. As the fuel burns, it removes up to 3 layers of skin from their bodies. Their backs would be left completely raw. We might use a liter of alcohol on them. The suffering is enormous.
Molly, I asked Chuck this earlier. Do you think that the Sicario is evil?
I don't know how to judge for myself whether a person is evil or good. I know in terms of what he believes about his religious conversion, he believes that it might be possible for God to forgive him, that if he can be forgiven, God is the only entity that could do that. But he said very clearly he's not sure God will forgive him, that his deeds may be so horrible that he cannot be forgiven. But that's his only hope.
Chuck Bowden and Molly Malloy. They've edited the new book, El Sicario, the autobiography of a Mexican assassin. A Sicario is a hitman for the drug cartels, and Chuck and Molly extensively interviewed a former Sicario who managed to live to tell his story. He paints a picture of corruption that he says stretches into the army, the state police, and all the way to the upper reaches of the Mexican government. He also speaks very candidly about the horrific things he did to torture the people that the cartels ordered him to kidnap and usually kill. The conversations that Chuck and Molly had with the Sicario were also filmed for a documentary by Italian filmmaker Gianfranco Rossi. And Molly, before the break, you were talking about the Sicario's religious conversion, leaving his violent life behind. Do you think that he's remorseful?
Absolutely. When we were doing the filming in the motel room that became the backdrop for both the movie and the book, really, he was wearing a veil that concealed his features completely. And we had talked to him for many hours face-to-face before we went into this room and he went before the camera disguised in this way. The change was absolutely enormous. The Sicario, I believe, went inside of himself. And he was speaking to himself. He was, you know, looking into his own soul and spitting it all out there. And it was terrible, terrible stuff. And it was very emotional. Several times we had to stop because he reached a point where he couldn't go on. He was sobbing to the point where he couldn't speak anymore. It was extremely emotional and powerful. And I think it was because he was under that veil. It was a kind of hypnotism almost. He was speaking to his very soul. It was just something amazing to watch and listen to.
You know, I'm not even religious, but I thought I was witnessing an exorcism in that room. I never want to see anything like that again as long as I live.
You know, you said his career as a Sicario started in the 80s. When did it end? How did he get out, Chuck?
Well, two ways. One way is they tried to kill him. He stole a bunch of money and they put a contract, a murder contract on his head that still exists. At the same time, he was going through these religious feelings and eventually became a born-again Christian. And I think your listeners should consider the fact that for him to become a born-again Christian is a stupid, lethal act. It means he becomes defenseless because he gives up killing. So I think he's sincere in that. So now he's essentially a helpless person without money, without the ability to even kill people, who has people looking for him all the time, who can get $250,000 for putting a bullet through his brain.
And what's his life like now with a price on his head? Are you still in touch with him? And what's happening?
We're not really in touch with him anymore. He lives as a fugitive. He never uses his real name. We don't know what his real name is. He also does have a family, and he goes to great lengths to protect these people. Every day when he gets up in the morning, probably, his major goal is to try to make enough money to support these people that depend on him and also to keep them safe. In a sense, his family would be better off if he completely disappeared from their lives as well. But he can't do that because he feels responsible for them. Plus, he has to live with these things in his mind that he knows he did, that, as he stated in his own words in the book, things that you cannot imagine. And yet he imagines them and re-experiences them every single day in his own memories.
Chuck, was the powerful emotional experience of watching this exorcism, as you describe it, was that enough to convince you that most of what he was telling you was credible? Or how did you know that some of it wasn't exaggerated, really?
I checked with the guy who trained him in the drug organization. I checked with the guy who was protecting him, you know, who was protecting him when they were hunting him. Molly has access to an enormous database of Chihuahuan newspapers. When we would find an incident he related, it always checked out in these little papers. It's pretty much what he said. There's an interesting thing with the film, that whenever we've shown it to American audiences, there's a desperate effort to say, oh, well, I don't know if he actually exists. Whenever we show it to Mexicans, they're terrified because they know he's real, and they know it absolutely. They're just totally convinced within minutes.
Because of this system, as you describe it, this very entrenched system in Mexico where, you know, it's the police, it's the army, it's everybody, the government, everybody seems to perpetuate this problem to get a piece of the multi-billion dollar drug trafficking scene. I wonder how it sort of fits in with, you know, what might be happening right now. We're hearing that the violence is intensifying in Mexico. Things just seem to get worse and worse.
In the last year that we believe this person was active as a killer operative for the Juarez cartel, if we go all the way to the end of 2007, just in the city of Juarez, there were about 320 murders that year. In 2008, more than 1,600 people were killed in Juarez. In 2009, more than 2,700 people. And in 2010, at least 3,100, possibly 3,900 people were killed just in the city of Juarez. So it's gotten not just worse, but worse by a factor of 10 since he left the business.
We're looking at his descendants. He's history. He's ancient. He's when things were structured. There are thousands of kids in Juarez like him now. There are little kids playing in the street pretending to be Sicarios. That's part of the reason he made the film. He can't undo what he did, but he realizes he is a role model for catastrophe for the Mexican people.
The book is El Sicario, the autobiography of a Mexican assassin. It was edited by our guests, Molly Malloy and Chuck Bowden. Chuck, Molly, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.